Hello, hello, hello. Hey guys, my name is Tyler. This is Lo-Fi Lit. I interview authors, poets, and publishers. Anyone I'm really interested in at the moment. Today, I'm talking to Jimin Seo, the author of Ossia, O-S-S-I-A. It is a poetry book. It deals with his mentor, Richard Howard. I did not know who Richard Howard was before this interview. I had heard the story about the Little Prince, but that's all I had heard. I didn't know he was gay. I didn't know who he was or any context. I know Jimin through Catch Fest. I saw him read at Catch Fest the first night. And his poetry was so gorgeous, so gay, and it avoided the trap of bad gay poetry. Anyways, the point is, I feel like this podcast, this interview, is a great foundation to get to know Jimin, if you don't know him.
Yeah, I was at the gym. I was moping today.
You're moping? Why?
Oh, this time of year is really weird for me because it's like right around when my mom died like 10 years ago. So I get into a kind of spiral. So then I take myself to the gym to like get my mind off things.
Damn. Yeah, one of my friends passed away around like July, and like I can't even control it. It just, like, it was a few years ago, and like around that time it gets depressing for some reason. It's not even like I'm not even thinking about it. It just happens.
Yeah, it's like the body remembers like what you kind of forget, and it never leaves you. So that's sort of what happens to me. And then it's my birthday like in December, and I like turned 30 right when she died. She died like 2 weeks after I turned 30, so it was kind of like a weird moment in my life, and I still remember it, oddly enough.
So do you work out every day? You're working and you worked out. You just worked out and now you're smoking.
Yeah, why not? It's a balance. There you
go. Yeah. When did you start working out? Have you always worked out?
I started working out, well, in college because, I don't know, it was just like kind of something to do. Mm-hmm. And then when I moved to New York when I was 25, it's like every gay man in New York City seemed to work out twice a week. And so I was like, do I have to do this to be viable? And I came out really late when I was like 23, and then I had to recant, and then I like put my foot down when I was 25. And then my family disowned me, that sort of thing. And then it just became kind of a compulsion to exercise, because I often dissociate. Like, I don't feel like I'm in my body or I exist. So my body kind of just, working out helps me just like be in my body. And it's eerily similar to classical piano, because that was my first sort of endeavor as a musician. And then I had a hand injury, so that's how I became a poet. So there are like these very technical things I do amateur powerlifting, and like the technical aspects of it are very similar to piano playing. Mm-hmm. I just kind of do it. And I guess also part of it is being like, you know, gay Asian man, and how that kind of the hierarchy of gay men in the world. So I like being, at least I'm strong. That's sort of the thing. If the stereotype is a feat, and which nothing is wrong with that, but I think it's more of a revolt against sort of gay white male, if you're like that kind of hierarchy, which New York is like particularly like that, I think.
Mm-hmm. You resent that? I would.
Yeah, I mean, I still do. Mm-hmm. Especially if no one believes me. I mean, it's kind of like Grindr or like Scruff or whatever, and I tell my friends, I was like, no one talks to me, and then they're like, that can't be true.
Wait, are you fucking serious?
Yeah, no, I'm serious. Yeah,
holy shit.
Yeah, it's like the, like, maybe like one or two people, and then I'll see my friends who are white, and I was like, and I've also done this experiment where I'm like, let me put up a fake photo, and I'm a white person, and then see what happens with like the same stats and the interaction is like entirely and totally different.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so you know it gets complicated in that way. So yeah, the resentment is there. So it becomes kind of exhausting. I think a friend of mine joked like there's like certain minuses, like being gay is minus one, being Asian or being non-white is another minus, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think really a is it compulsive, my working out? Well, I don't like working out, but I do it anyway.
Oh, you don't like
So
it?
no, I don't like it. I like it when I'm done, I think.
Yeah.
It's the same thing as writing. I don't like writing, and I like it when it's finished. Or it's sort of similar to, I don't know. I mean, music is interesting. When I'm practicing piano, it's like working out where my sense of time is totally distorted. So I feel like I'm out of time, which is more comfortable and more similar to kind of dissociating with my body. And writing, I think, does something similar, but there is a much less abstract component to it. So that's probably why I dislike writing. But yeah, I mean, and I guess I like, if I were to rank it, I like practicing, I like exercising, purely in like the time sensibility or the temporal quality, and writing the least, because then I have to actually examine my body in a way and how it works with the world sort of contextually.
When you're working out, do you ever create new exercises?
No, I mean, the other thing is I used to be a personal trainer. So
Oh,
there is,
really?
yeah, so this used to be, it's like, it's usually the simple exercises is very boring over a long period of time. That's how you see however you want to understand progress. The new kind of, like, I like to tell my, if when I had clients that we're not professional athletes, and professional athlete training schedule is 5 times a day, twice a day usually. With like depending like specifically for the sport that they're training for. And most of us don't need that. So maybe like 45 minutes at the gym is okay if you're doing it properly. Cardio is more important, that sort of thing for longevity. And then everything else is kind of virtuosic. It's extra. Which is, I think, also important just because we're the idea of, you know, it's kind of very similar to art making, right? You go beyond what is considered normal. So it does become sort of subversive, much like writing, where you go beyond what is necessary, and that satisfies something else.
So, can we go back to your family like disowned you when you came out?
Sure.
So what, how do they like, how did you come out?
Yeah, so I came out, so I knew, I think I was not, you know, I knew I was queer, I think fairly early on when I was 10. And it's probably now thinking of it contributes to my body displacement, where there were things, I mean, I'm by no means trans, but like, I was like, wouldn't it be much better if I were a woman, and I didn't shame my family, then I could like men. That really came to a head because the reason I studied music so seriously was that I would have one life and one love, and that would be music. And of course, that doesn't work. So after years of being in the closet, I thought, you know, I thought I'd met someone when I was 23 on gay.com, of all things. I'm 42. And then I just couldn't bear it anymore. And then I told my mother and my brother, and they were extremely upset. They said they wouldn't tell my father because, I don't know, something about telling my dad, and as the head of the household, culturally speaking, was not something that he should know, and it's shameful. So then I recanted. And then I moved to New York for grad school when I was 25. And I, again, thought I met someone, that I'd fallen in love. And then I came home, and then I said, I'll tell my dad. So I sat my dad down, and I couldn't even spit out the words, I'm gay.
Wow.
I was stuttering, and I think I said, this is the reason I won't get married. And then my dad was like, what do you mean? And then he goes, your mother told me. And I felt so betrayed. And immediately, like, they gave me an ultimatum. I remember it was like 7 o'clock at night, and they said, you either stop being gay or you leave the house. And I booked a ticket, and I immediately left, went to the airport, and came back to New York. I remember it was my second semester starting, and it was at the time it was a workshop, a first year seminar with Lucy Brock-Broido, and it was the first time I was meeting her with like 13 other students, and I had a Dunkin' Donuts cup filled with Jameson, and I said, well, if anyone asks, I'll say it's like tea, iced tea. And it was an incredible class, actually, because I think I was just fuck it all. And I remember there was a discussion about one of Hopkins' poem and what the dark crystal was. And I just said what I thought it was. And after the class ended, my friends, I think it was Leandra and Jay, were like, you smell. You just reeked of whiskey. And I was like, oh my God, really? And then I told them, I'm like, yeah, I'm gay, FYI. And that's how it came out. I had a lot of drunken nights. I would go out because a friend of mine who was a philosopher, who still is, said, you know, now's probably a good time to drink. And I remember calling my parents drunkenly. And then my mother would be very cold. My father would just say this, that, and the other. And after another year, I called and they were in Korea and they were seeing a shaman, and shaman was like, there's a ghost following your son around who's making him more feminine than he actually is.
Oh my God.
So they asked me to come out to take care of this ghost. So I had an exorcism for like 10 hours and it wasn't painful.
Wait, you did?
Yeah. I had an exorcism. It's like Korean shamanism, and it wasn't violent. Physically speaking, it wasn't like electroshock therapy or whatever. Mm-hmm. And she was a medium, and I met all my ancestors. And this was in August. And honestly, it did feel like the air. It was like a temple. There was an altar and everything. And she said, in 6 months, which would be like April 1st, I would be cured and I would no longer be gay, which was, you know, sort of coincidentally April Fool's Day. So clearly it didn't work.
So wait, I have a question. So is this kind of like, did you have to kind of put on like a performance, almost like, you know, like in the South, like people like speak in tongues?
It wasn't that. It's like she was reciting in Sanskrit. Because it's like very much tied to like Buddhist shamanism in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of the text or the language used is similar. And it really wasn't a performance because part of me wanted to make my family happy.
Yeah.
And in some ways, now that I think about it, like maybe I did want to not be gay for the sake of my family. But then it's just sort of like my mother died thinking I was still a virgin. She would ask me, why can't you just live with me? I was very close to my mother. We would call 3 times a day. We're pretty much inseparable, which I thought would be ideal for a mother. And then it just sort of, they all knew, they sort of accepted it. I remember my brother, when I came out, he was not great. I remember asking him, would you tell a Black person in America to not be Black? And then, it was totally false equivalency on my part, but then he said, yes. And I don't think he really believed it, but I was like, and at that point I knew there was no convincing anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, and it was quite complicated, but my mother had, in order to save money from like not to have my dad not know, had a bunch of like stocks and bonds in my name. So I like had money. I like severed whatever access that they had to my account. And I was like, this will be my nest egg. But then we made up and I gave it all back to them and whatever. But that's how I came out. And I guess that's very formative, whether I like to, whether I know it now or not. There is one poem that alludes to that in my book. Yeah, it's when it's the poem Richard tries to set me up, where I tell him, like, well, he talks to me and he said, the last time I was like accused of being queer, I went and flew for an exorcism and came back circumcised, that sort of bit, which is also true. But, you know, it's, I mean, I can't escape the idea of being a queer person. Right. Yeah. In my own poetics, when I started writing poetry, because I came to it after piano, it was like an accident. Like I just took a class that was open, and then I told myself this is the one space I won't lie. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, like this space of poetry was really important for me. But I also, I think similarly, because I feel so out of my body, have trouble writing about myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I think partially this is why the book isn't dramatic monologues for the most part, and the voices of people I love. And I have a chapbook coming out and I'm trying to write about myself. And so I'm calling it A1982, which is the year of my birth, and A stands for autobiography. So I'm trying. So trying more and more, I guess. But I think it's definitely, I'm a queer poet and the queer sensibilities are, I mean, regardless of whether it's direct kind of information. Mm-hmm. I think the way I sort of obscure, hide, elide, I think that much, that is very much queer poetics.
So are you more comfortable writing through someone else's, I don't know, voice is the right term, or like disguising, I don't know, disguise?
Yeah, so this is the thing where, you know, the classical music is you're playing another composer. So I had very good training in emulating another person's voice, because that's really essentially all of classical music. And then you're supposed to kind of develop a voice of your own while performing, you know, the work of another composer. And I think that was very comfortable for me. So when I was writing, I'm very good at clapping voices.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, like Richard, I was very close to, was a dear friend. My mother, I was very close to. So it was really easy to emulate their voice. So I think it is difficult writing in my own voice in a way. And as I'm writing new work, I find myself veering away from autobiography. So it's kind of a tension between... yeah, so it's a healthy, interesting tension, trying to come back to my my own voice, and not either working too abstractly like music, because the language of music is quite abstract.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's more creative to be speaking through other people than like doing like something autobiographical.
Yeah,
and that's what poetry is. Therefore, to experiment with. When you, is there a process for when you're going to sit down and like write through someone else's voice to like get in their head or face?
I think specifically for this book, I knew I was writing monologues in Richard's voice, because it was then when he was diagnosed with dementia, and I didn't know, it was during COVID, and he didn't remember who I was, so I sort of desperately started writing in his voice. Mm-hmm. So it was like a kind of a selfish desire to have him remember me. So for that, those particular 15 poems, I did know I was doing that. And then I wrote responses to that voice. But when I'm writing not in dramatic monologue, then I don't think I think about it. I think I just sort of sit down and write. And it's usually a subject matter, a gas station that I grew up working in, that sort of thing.
You worked in a gas station?
Yeah, my parents had a gas station since I was like 9. So I worked as like a little cashier boy since I was 10 in Florida.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Which is where I grew up in Jacksonville.
How was that growing up?
It's interesting. I mean, I immigrated to the States when I was 8, and then I lived in Fresno for a year. And my parents came before, so I was separated from my mother for 6 years, and my dad I hadn't really met till I moved here, although he came to Korea briefly once, I remember. And so my idea of being an American, also, like, my mother was an illegal immigrant and undocumented, which I didn't know until much later, that I grew up with, like, a very Southern sensibility, that there were only two races, really. But three. I mean, this is the interesting thing about being Asian, at least as an immigrant. You don't think about yourself as Asian, but the purview is you're white or you're black.
Really?
At
Wow.
least, for me. And so, I absorbed a lot of sort of Southern Confederate ideas, where the Confederate flag was just the preservation of history. Any sort of racist remarks about Black Americans were very much just, this is how it is. White people are the best, and you should try to emulate them, even as there were clearly sore points for my parents about being immigrants. I grew up in that, and I wasn't really disabused of that until I moved to New York in 2008. That there were different ways to live. For all I knew, anyone who was, like Latino, Latina, Latinx, or Middle Eastern, for all intents and purposes, they were all white to me. And it wasn't really until I moved to New York that it was like, oh no, I mean, this is how sort of American fascism works, right? So then I had to do a lot of unlearning, where when I was initially writing poetry, it was, even playing classical music was a very white Western canon thing. And I was very much writing, like, T.S. Eliot was my favorite poet, Four Quartets was my favorite poem. And I would try to write in that sort of modernist, very objective, essential, non-biographical, which makes sense. This is the appeal, being an immigrant here, poems. And then slowly, I think I'm trying to escape from that. And I don't know, is there postmodernism in literature is a question, and there's enough literature to say there isn't, but or just kind of the fracturing of postmodernism into, or that idea into, everything else, like TV, fashion, and whatnot. But so I'm trying to resist this sort of monolithic modernist objective idea. And I think I'm constantly working against that. And it's a process. Not that modernism doesn't teach you things, but yeah, I think that's still there.
So the whiteness that's associated with the classical music that you learned when you were young, was that like did they play that during when you were working at the gas station? They have it on in the background?
No music. My
Oh,
dad
no
hated
music.
music. I
Like
still
he hated music.
remember, yeah, in the car, we weren't allowed to play music. I would always look at his eyes in the rearview mirror to see what his mood was, because my dad was extremely moody. And he grew up extremely poor, like abject poverty, post-war Korea. And looking back, he inherited a lot of trauma. And I wasn't really allowed to listen to music or dance or things like that, because this is extremely racist. This is what my parents would say. If you dance to music, this is what black people do, and we're not supposed to be black. And so I remember, like, a specific memory where I was listening to, of all things, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and like jamming out on an old CD player. And my mom immediately, like, made fun of me and told me to stop.
Oh my God.
It was like highly racialized, in that way.
So, but they supported you playing music.
I mean, I wasn't a particularly good student. My brother was always academically excellent, and I wasn't, so they didn't have much hopes for me. So they kind of let me do whatever I wanted, which was perfect for a poet in hindsight. I mean, I was extremely disciplined in playing piano, but the idea of an immigrant is to come here and make money, and if you're a pianist, you're not going to make any money. So their entire trajectory for my life as the youngest was to have me live with them and take care of them and teach at the local school. So they really didn't have expectations for me. And it wasn't until I got into Columbia, which they thought I was lying about it. And when I graduated, they thought I didn't graduate. Because, yeah, that they had to see the diploma. But it also made sense because I would skip school all the time in high school. My grades weren't great. But yeah, it was my parents, I guess back to your initial question, was later, I think when I went to college for music, then I was practicing all of the time. And even before that, I was doing that. But as far as playing music, minus karaoke, which they loved, there wasn't really music. I'm like, yeah, Koreans love karaoke.
So I guess like this makes more, so if you juxtapose your relationship with the parent, your parents, with Richard and you finding a mentor, I can see why the mentorship would be so, such a strong connection. Like,
yeah. I mean,
can you talk about Richard?
Yeah, Richard, I met, actually the first time I met Richard was when I was in my undergrad at Florida State. He came to do a reading, and I think it was 2007, and it was the silent treatment. Which amusingly is, you know, about like Freudian psychoanalysis, you know, adjacently or exactly. And at that time I wasn't applying to MFAs and I didn't know who Richard was, because I was very young in my writing. And I came to Columbia because it was the only school that accepted me. I applied to four schools. I got waitlisted for my first choice, which was UVA. And then Columbia accepted me. And then I went to Columbia and I'd taken Richard's class. I think it was my, it was my second semester. I had him for workshop and I remember going to see him. So what you did with Richard is that he didn't do a standard workshop. He would sit in his class and he was convinced no one was well read in poetry, which is true. Mm-hmm. And so he would pick one poet, and for an hour and a half, we would read their poems. And then you would go to his apartment and you would bring in three poems. And for 30 minutes, you would sit while he went over your poems, which is horrifying.
You would go to his apartment, like as a class?
Yeah, as a class, each of us would make an appointment. We would go to his apartment. If you were late, you were flogged, basically. And so you could never be late. And I remember I took him some poems and I said, he said, I really don't know like what's going on in your poetry. Because my poetry at the time was very experimental, which really, really wasn't. But I wasn't using any punctuation. It was very clean. It was very technical. And he asked me to bring in like 10 poems. Very generous. I was like, okay, Richard, here you go. Here's 10. And then I saw him for 30 minutes. I don't remember what he said. And I left. And then I was just walking around town. I think it was West Village. And he called me, which was bizarre. And he called to apologize. And he said, I didn't mean to imply you only write love poems. Like, I can't do that. And I just wanted to apologize. And, you know, for me, being Korean and what someone, a teacher, kind of that stature was, I mean, I was taken aback. Because the idea that you could be friends with someone who was your elder was a totally foreign concept to me. So, you know, that sort of developed into a friendship. And then I came out and there was a whole thing where the school put me on suicide watch because I skipped class. Yeah, I mean, there was this thing, trigger warning, where I missed Richard's class and not Richard, Lucy's class. And two of my friends at the time had told Lucy that I was going to commit suicide and that's why I didn't come to class. So while I was cleaning my dishes, someone knocks at my apartment door and it's Lucy and my two friends, who I won't name, who came to my apartment. They told the school. The school took me on to like the psych ward at like Columbia Presbyterian.
Oh my God.
And it was this thing where they coerced me to see a school counselor at the school, but also sign a disclosure form saying that anything I said to the therapist or the clinician would be disclosed to deans.
Oh,
and
God.
That the worry was that if it got out, I try to commit suicide, then it would cause a string of suicides because we are, as writers, volatile. And so I saw a therapist. It wasn't very effective. And I remember he was a queer Asian man, and he said, from what you're telling me, it seems like you don't need your parents, which is horrible advice and not useful at all. And that was the end of it. And at the time, I think Richard really was concerned. He was worried. And so we just spent a lot of time together. I kind of unofficially became his assistant. He would translate, because he was a big French to English translator. He would dictate, organize his library, go to the movies, eat dinners with his partner, David.
Oh, he was gay?
Yeah. Yeah, Richard. Oh. Yeah, Richard is gay, and so is David. And so it was just kind of this queer life I didn't know was possible. That you could have. I mean, I don't think I even knew what friendship was or is. Still, I'm kind of coming to understand that, because I tend to be fairly private, even as I tell you all these things. And I mean, part of the reason I can just say these things pretty easily and readily is because it just seems like information, and like my life narrative doesn't matter. And then we became just kind of really close. I think he's the person I really loved and admired and liked being around. As he'd be horrified, but like kind of like a family member.
Mm-hmm. Why would he be horrified?
I don't know. Richard like didn't want kids, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
It was horrible. You know, it's that kind of queer life. Like, why do you have to live a heterosexual life, for instance? And so he also showed me what it means to have like a life of letters. And I remember he made it a point that the idea that you have to differentiate or specialize between poet, prose writer, it was kind of ridiculous in a way, because that as you read and you read everything, that you really are a person of letters, and that's the life he led.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he knew that you were gay before you'd come out?
You know, I never asked Richard that.
Like when he first called you.
Yeah.
Do you think he maybe knew, and like he was like more maybe concerned about you than the other students?
I don't know. I mean, I'd like to say it's because my poems were interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's entirely possible. Because Richard was very, not stern, but if he didn't like your work, he just told you flat out.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to think he was pretty objective about it. But my poems, you know, have the classic signs of me writing about my mother a lot, kind of the eros and the erotics of the body. A kind of a self-effacement, and he's an extremely astute reader, so he probably knew already.
So you think it was because of the work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when do you start becoming his like assistant? Like he just kind of takes you under his wing.
Yeah, I mean, we just started spending a lot of time, and I mean, the assistant part was a joke. I remember the French embassy, the Alliance Française, emailed the school looking for Richard's assistant. The office called me and said, they're looking for Richard's assistant. And then I told Richard, I was like, Richard, I guess I'm your assistant. And he laughed and he said, is that still useful? Because, you know, he was quite powerful back in the time, like the day where he was the poetry editor for the Paris Review.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah, for a really, really long time.
Oh.
He edited the Boer... now I forget. I think the Braziller series. He published Frank Bedard's first book, Golden Gay. He discovered A.R. Ammons, for instance. So he was a very much, he was quite the tastemaker, to use that old term, in terms of what poetry was like in New York, which, you know, affected things nationally. I mean, he had quite a number of students, I think, that owe him quite a bit for their careers. So That's how I became his assistant. But you know, it was really just kind of spending time together. I didn't show him my poems because after my mother died, I'd stopped writing. So it was just work, spending time, that sort of thing. And in hindsight, I'm really glad I didn't use him because I remember he was in the hospital once and he was really frustrated with me. And he said, "You know, you can use me while I'm useful." But I really don't like that conflation between personal relationships and professional relationships, and I'm glad that I this the work, my book came after his death. But I'm quite sad that I didn't get to show him anything,
Oh shit.
but I'm glad it wasn't a working relationship.
Why didn't you use him? Well, I guess you just explained that. But did he do you think he wanted you? Like, what
He
do you mean
did.
use? What do you mean use?
Here's my manuscript. Will you give it to Knopf and have them publish it?
Did he ever ask for a manuscript from
He
you?
did. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Did he have other students like working for him like you? Or were you the
Yeah, there were several before
Oh.
me. Yeah, there were,
Okay.
I think most notably Craig Morgan Tiger, Mark
See,
Bibbins.
I don't know his names.
Yeah, they're poets.
Okay. I'm gonna have to look them up.
And they did quite, you know, they're quite well set. Samuel Amidon is another. So yeah, and I guess I'm his last one, I guess, whatever that means. His least successful one, I joked at his memorial when there was a reading for him, but yeah.
But you wrote a book about him, though.
Yeah, I did. I did.
You're not the least
And
successful. And your
well,
career's, you know.
yeah, I mean, what is success in poetry? I mean, it
Yeah.
really isn't anything. I mean, even Richard would say that he would be remembered as a minor poet. And he's won every award that you could probably get besides the Nobel. And he said, you know, I'm a minor poet. I won't be remembered. His translations are prolific, and everyone's probably read his translations. I mean, he translated The Little Prince, for instance.
Oh, okay.
Like most of Roland Barthes.
Wait, did he hate translating The Little Prince?
He did, yeah.
Someone just on another show said that.
Yeah, he
We were
didn't
talking about
like it.
translations.
Oh, I'll have to listen to that podcast. I wonder who it was. But yeah, he hated it. He did it in 4 hours. He refused to take royalties, but they made him take 1%.
They made him?
Yeah, he was like, "I don't want to take royalties," but
You don't want to be associated with it?
yeah, so he took 1%.
Did he look down on it?
I don't think he looked down on it. I just don't think he liked the work.
Oh, okay.
And I also think that he just didn't like Exupéry's works. He had opinions and quite strong ones.
So are you going to take someone under your wing like he took you under his?
I don't know. It's not something I love teaching. And I'm quite I love teaching, and I think I'm generous with my time in that regard. But I'm a little wary. I'm scared of close relations. And I think with Richard, it just happened very naturally in a way. But I was also, it wasn't the easiest thing being his assistant,
Oh,
or
really?
that title. Not because he was difficult, but it was me. It was sort of being in proximity to someone who was so grand. It's like being with a celebrity, in some sense. And you know, I had students who would say, like, "You're the teacher who changed my life the most, and I'll remember you forever." And my immediate response is like, "Well, I'm horrified," because I don't want the responsibility of changing their life. But you know, it's a beautiful thing, and I'm glad I had a positive. I did something good for the student when they needed it. But I think because of my family, I'm so scared of close relationships. So if it happens that I mentor someone, hopefully like when I'm like 80, sure.
When you're 80.
Yeah, but right now the thought of it is just really frightening.
Do you think your relationship with Richard is going to be like the closest one you've had? That's maybe like non-sexual.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. At least in, yeah, I mean, there was, we came from such different places. I mean, Richard was like shamelessly adopted, and then, you know, ended up in a really like rich family in Cleveland and grew up with without needing for anything. And, you know, and wait, what was the question again, Tyler?
What was the question? I forget what I'm asking. Do you think, do you, oh, I asked, do you think it'll be the closest
oh
non-sexual
yeah.
relationship that you'll ever have?
Yeah,
Like, even like, do you think it'll be the closest relationship we'll have, even if you had a sexual one with someone? Because I feel like sometimes our friendships can be closer than
I
with
think he's
partners.
someone I would have probably do anything for, that sort of thing. So in the, if that's a measure of closeness, where nothing is, you know, there would be no boundaries for what I would, if he needed help. Well, he never needed really help, but like, I mean, to the extent that I think of him quite often, and not his, and it's like not his work either, although I think of that, but it's sort of his, you know, like the things we did, what he was like I have his books, and then I would open the book and the smell of his apartment would come. I would have fond memories of it. But I mean, a part of it is also, it's just all fond memories. I have no bad memories of Richard. And I think
What's
that's
like,
quite rare.
what's your favorite memory of him?
My favorite memory was when we were going, where were we going? It was his apartment. And his apartment building, there's a little courtyard, and he loved the color red, and everything in his apartment is red.
Oh, really?
And there was this, the apartment had planted this holly branch for holiday decorations, and he asked me to look left and right to see if anyone was coming, and he yanked the holly branch, and then we rushed into the apartment and then planted in another red vase.
Oh, nice. So is that why in the book you talk about a red room?
His room was exuberantly red. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And
That's a...
it was his favorite color. Yeah.
And then you also talk about like waking up in pink or something. There's pink is referenced a few
Yeah,
times.
pink is referenced, I think, sort of as, you know, a queer color. You know, but also kind of a less saturated version of red. Sort of a ghost or a shadow of that color, which, if you read it figuratively, maybe that would be quite different. But
So why was red his favorite color?
yeah, I never asked him. I think he just, it's vibrant and he liked it. I mean, he liked other colors, but that's the color he's known for the
Oh,
most. And now
wow.
I know. Yeah. He would always match outfits. It'd be like very monochromatic. He had these always his beautiful round spectacles, and he would have them in every color, and his outfits would match.
Would you have to buy clothes for him? Or would he
No,
like go shopping?
he would go shopping, or sometimes he would stop by a window, and there was something he liked, and he'd say, "Isn't that nice?" And then we would go in, and he would either buy it or not buy it.
So were you working other jobs at the time?
Yeah, I worked as a personal trainer. I also
Oh, okay,
taught. I
yeah.
adjuncted, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you go to him for like advice?
The one advice I asked for was if he, when I wasn't writing, I asked him if there was such a thing as writer's block. And then he said, no, it means you just don't want to write. And it gave me the freedom not to write.
I
But I
saw that in your
didn't,
interview.
yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the only advice I'd asked for or given. And that he gave me. I'm trying to think, did I ask him for advice?
Like maybe about relationships or anything?
No, I
No?
didn't. Although he did find me my first therapist.
Oh, he did? Oh,
Yeah.
nice.
So there was that. Yeah, no, we really didn't. We mostly didn't talk about poetry. We mostly talked about music.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Did
because
you
he
ever play
also,
music for him?
I played music at his 80th birthday that Columbia threw for him, which he absolutely hated because he didn't like a spectacle. and I was set to play the piano and I was playing, but because the hall was so loud, no one could hear me and he was very cranky.
Well, that's funny.
Yeah.
So when you started sliding into dementia, how was that for you?
It was hard.
Yeah. Was terrifying?
Yeah, it was terrifying, and I think it was a loss. And I had no idea. I mean, I just called him, and it was peak COVID, and no one could see each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the vaccine came out, I was able to, you know, see him. I would visit him, and I would read him, because he liked being read to. At that point, the dementia was quite advanced. I'm going to smoke a cigarette.
Okay.
And I would read him, and he would light up, right? It's the thing the body remembers, and he would remember certain things. I would read him his own poems. I remember reading him Donald Justice's poems, but he didn't like them, or he didn't really react. But then if I'd read him something else, he would say occasionally, like, "Oh, that's really good," which was mostly about his own work, which was great.
Yeah.
I would read him like a prose passage he'd written, and he's like, "Oh, that's good." And I was like, "I know, it's yours."
Was that
and
hard?
It was hard, and I actually read him the poems I'd written in his voice to him. And I remember like holding back tears and trying not to sob as I was reading them to him, but I knew he hated when people cried. I was just swallowing tears.
So, did the COVID like exacerbate the issue? Shit. Yeah, my grandpa, he ended up passing away because he had a tumor or something in his urinary tract. And the first screening he went to, like everything was fine, but then he needed to go to the second one. They probably would have found out what was wrong with him, but.
Yeah,
because of COVID, and so he ended up passing away.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. COVID's a bitch.
Yeah, it's a bitch. I think. Yeah, it just really did steal a lot. Of time.
But was his partner there?
Yeah.
With him.
Okay. Yeah, well, he was there too. So he always had a caretaker. And, you know, David was also there. They loved each other very much. So I'm glad that they were able to spend time together.
Did he try to write?
The last poem he'd written, and this was before COVID really, was like a 5-page poem about pigeons in Washington Square Park.
That's cool.
But that was the last thing he'd written. Yeah. But he was constantly working, like till he couldn't really.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was translating. I think the last thing he was supposed to translate were I think it was Cioran's diaries. That was the last project he was working on.
But even when you were reading poems to him, was he still trying to work?
At that point, no, he couldn't.
He physically couldn't.
He physically couldn't, and the kind he had, the Lewy body dementia, was it like affects your body, your nervous system. He couldn't hold a pen or read.
Okay, but even like, I guess what I'm asking is like, maybe his body couldn't work, but his brain would want to or something.
Yeah, so it's interesting. With the Wee body, you have hallucinations, like physical ones.
Oh, shit.
And his was meeting clients and writing. So sometimes he would like mime writing or like meeting an agent or something. It was actually quite endearing in a way. Because I've heard of some other friends who had Lewy body. One of the ones was a prima ballerina, and hers was hosting a party in her huge apartment and things not going right. So I think it could have been much worse for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the loss, how has that been? Like, has it been like lonely, I guess, because you lost this person?
Yeah, I mean, it is lonely, but he is in every book.
Yeah, that's true. You have the book. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, the motorcycle is about to go.
Oh, you're good.
But I can find him. That's the most beautiful thing about having a friend as a writer. You can always come back to the work.
Yeah.
And he's there. And he, you know, he wrote dramatic monologues, so his voice was kind of inimitable. So I can hear him constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of reenact that. So I miss him, yeah. How could we not? But yeah, but at least he's there in words.
So he edited the Parish Review. Have you thought about starting a magazine or editing? Have you been an editor?
No, I'm editing. I'm like a co-editor at Couplet Poetry, which is an online zine. And my friend Asa Drake, who's a wonderful poet, we're going to start a literary journal called Literary Classifieds,
which
we'll launch that in 2025.
Oh, nice. What is the magazine? Like, what's the theme?
So it's going to be run like classifieds.
Oh,
so the idea
cool.
is that there's this anthology by the poet Walter de la Mare that he, the anthology was called Love. Mm-hmm. And it was just all poems. There were no poets attached to the poems, and the poets' names were only in the index. So what we want to do is do something similar where there'll be a rolling, however many, 25 poets, and on a separate page would just be the names of the contributors, but it's up to the poets to claim the poem if they want to. So it really has to be an act of love in order to read the poems, and that's the idea.
But they know they're going to be in the magazine.
Yeah. But then we figured if we have enough issues,
okay.
You really, unless the poet claims the poem, you won't know whose it is.
Oh, that's cool. Is this going to be like in a newspaper form? Or is it going to be on the internet?
No, it'll be on the internet. Until we, I think, figure out money situation, which is always the prohibitive thing. It'll be online. But I think we'll design it in a way where it'll scroll like a newspaper. So mm-hmm. That's the idea.
Well, that's smart. You could do it on your phone, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no margins. Idea. Yeah, so that's the idea. Yeah, and I guess the next thing is, will I translate? I don't know.
Will you?
I should, and I practice translating. I mean, I have translations, but I'm too scared to send them out.
What's your biggest issue with translating?
I think it's really honestly Richard. The way he translated was he would just translate, and I thought everyone just translated that proficiently.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started doing it, I was like, well, no, it's not that easy.
Yeah. The last guy that I had on, he was talking about how some translators are very technical.
Mm.
And I guess this guy was going off the emotion that he felt.
That's kind of a debate in translation practices now, actually, that Johannes Goransson and Joel McSweeney wrote this book called The Deformation Zones, and translation itself is its own artwork, and that language is not meant to exactly, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but they deform.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't the idea of an accurate translation is actually not very useful.
How do you feel?
Or true. I think that's right. I also think so.
Are there translations that you read and like, I hate this, I can't do this?
Yeah, I do.
Like who? Who's the worst translator?
Who's the worst translator? I can't think of anything on the top of my head, but it's usually for me, like, not current contemporary translations of Korean, whether it's prose or poetry, but there are some, I think, done in like the 80s or even the 90s that I find, I even forget their names actually, but it's immediate rejection. And it has to do, I think, with that idea of they try to enact an exact translation. And I'm sure it's like this in other languages, but Korean can be extremely sentimental if it's translated incorrectly. Or the sensibility is wrong. And that's the thing about translation. It's not the words. You have to translate the sensibility. I think Anton Herr talks about in one of his talks about when you translate or you read a line, you know exactly where the person's been, exactly how the person's feeling, or the writer or the character. And that's what you're also translating in, on top of the words or the sentence or the line. And
And I think that's sort of the thing that's quite ineffable. You can't exactly describe what it means to feel what the person was feeling at the time that they were writing and then to translate that. Mm-hmm. And I think this is why there should be multiple translations of the same work. That the idea of a definitive translation is crazy. because how do you translate sentiment exactly?
That's true.
Yeah.
Is there translator beef?
I'm assuming so, but I don't know much of it because I'm not in the translating world. But how could there not be?
I feel like you're in the translating world.
There's poet beef, so there has to be translator beef.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I think this is also the specifics of why I don't want to get into translation. Is what if I get into a beef? I don't want to be in a beef.
Yeah, I don't know. So, I forgot what I was going to ask you. When you translate something, do you have to know about the person's work? Do you have to know about their life?
Well, that's interesting, right? When you mention, when you talk about knowing someone's life, you essentially have to know their history, right? The historical context of where they grew up. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, Han Gang won the Nobel, and she writes a lot about the Gwangju Massacre. She's of a certain age, how she grew up, what was the political climate at the time. So I think you do have to know that. Especially if that's what they're talking about. Maybe for instance, I was reading recently like Human Acts, translated by Deborah Smith. And I could can't imagine that Deborah wouldn't know or have researched about that time in Korean history and then translate Human Acts. Yeah. I don't think that's possible. Yeah. So I think for that sense, like knowing the person really means knowing the historical context.
So you said though Richard was always translating all the time. Did he always know about the author and their history?
He
and
was, for him, luckily they were friends. Like he was friends with Roland Barthes. He knew Foucault. He didn't know Stendhal, but he'd read enough.
He knew Barthes?
Yeah, he knew Barthes. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, they were friends. Yeah. And the last book, Morning Diaries, that was, I think that was Barthes' posthumous book. There'll be references to R, and that's Richard.
Have you thought about doing a podcast? You'd be really good.
Really?
With everything that you know?
So? I don't know if I know. I do?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's the thing. I don't think I know anything.
You know everything, man. You know, like, an entire world I know, because it's all, like, I think academia, it's very high culture.
Oh, I don't, is it? But I know so little of what you know. Yeah.
We know different things.
Yeah, we all know different things. And I think it's the same thing about translating. Like, we know so many different things. And I think that would, right, like, my sort of history would also inform how I translate.
Mm-hmm.
Because translation isn't a self-effacing gesture. It's everything subjective. So my own sensibilities would inform how I translate.
Yeah, I heard you talking on another interview where you said, like, your mom and dad's, like, you're Korean. It was, like, from, like, the 80s or the 90s.
Yeah.
And it's, like, totally different from today. So if you translated something, would that clash?
Yeah, it would, I think. I probably would have a very hard time translating contemporary Korean poets.
For real?
Yeah. I would have to do quite a bit of reading.
Is it that more much different? Reading.
It's quite different, yeah. It is.
How did it change so
drastically? The language updated. And if I'm talking about my parents' Korean, they immigrated in the early 80s and my dad in the late 70s. And that means their Korean is also kind of frozen. And if that's the one I learned, they were also kind of probably older than 70s and 80s Korean. And so mine is quite old and theirs never updated. So there's like modern lingo, sort of common phrases. Like the life of a Korean person now is very different than a child who grew up in the 80s under a dictatorship in Korea. So.
Mm-hmm.
I would probably do well with sort of my parents' generation poets rather than contemporary poets now.
I would have to do quite a bit of research, yeah.
If you went over to Korea, you could have probably a better conversation with someone that's from an older generation, like the older
people. I think I would be more comfortable. I mean, I can have conversations in Korean, but I think it's same thing, like cadence. The music of my Korean from the 80s mm-hmm. is stuck. It never updated. So they recognize my cadence, my certain vocabulary words that changed. Yeah, that would very much... I'm immediately noticeable as like a Kyokpo, which is like someone who immigrated.
Do you think it'd be easier to be gay over there than over here?
Oh my God, no. I think no, being queer in Korea is like not easy. It's Seoul in particular is like, it's a great place to visit. It's a really hard place to live. Not to mention like the recent martial law, impeachment, plus the air crash today.
There was an air crash?
Yeah, like 177 people died. I think the death count, that happened last night at 1 in the morning Eastern time. And,
whoa.
And the birth rate is like 0.7, so the government is paying people money to have children. It's real hard to live because the wages are so low, but the expenses are so high that it's an extremely hard place to live.
I was going to ask you, I guess you don't, you just got done working out, so you don't have your book in front of you.
Obviously. Oh, I actually don't.
Yeah.
Did you want me to read I was something? Gonna ask,
yeah, I was going to ask. But in the book, there's like certain poems that are, it's like, it has the, it's OCI.
Osea.
Those poems are gray as opposed mm-hmm. to the other poems are like on the white background. What's the difference mm-hmm. there?
The Osea it's gray, so that, you know, you already know what that means. It's an alternate. So the corresponding Korean on that, the Osea, the gray page poems aren't translated. So that exists solely in Korean.
Oh, so the word means gray?
Oh no, the Osea means alternate or alternatively. Oh. It's actually a musical term. It's Italian.
Okay.
And if you look at the score, sometimes the composer will indicate another way to play a passage. And it's often simplified version of it. The most famous one is it's not exactly an Osea, but Rachmaninoff has two cadenzas for his third piano concerto. One is simpler. And one is known to be more technically horrendously difficult. But, you know, Schumann, for instance, in his Papillon, Opus 2, I think it's the second character piece. In one of the passages, he offers an alternate way to play a particular few measures. And so the idea was that gray is the idea of what is an alternate version of language.
Oh, that's cool. It's very deep.
No, I guess so. I never thought about it quite that way, but I think that's how I think a lot of immigrants or non-monolingual speakers live.
Yeah.
So it's just part of, I think, living, and I just happened to put a name to it through poetry.
Have you written essays where you come up with some like really deep thing like that?
Yeah, I wrote.
Change the world.
That's going to change the world. I don't know if it'll change the world, but I am writing. I found out since I have a background in music, my primary interest is in how music and poetry work. And there's been plenty of studies on this, that one of the questions, and I think this was first posed by Sir Philip Sidney, was, is poetry music and is music poetry? And after very long debates, it was determined music is not poetry. But if you look at sort of poetic practice, any sort of adjective to describe poetry is often music, the language of music.
Yeah.
And I think that's most prominent in the objectivist poets. If you look at Louis Zubkowski's first objectivist manifesto, then you'll see that it's very much the lexicon of music. And I think it's no surprise that Zubkowski's son was Paul. Zubkowski was an extremely famous, an extremely accomplished violinist.
Have you set any of your poems to music? Because I know like with the Beats, like with Baraka, like they would like write to jazz, or like they would have jazz playing.
I think my take is, I mean, for classical song cycles, I think that's a particular case. I find most poetry set to music now, oh my God, I'm gonna get so canceled for this, it's unsuccessful.
Yeah. Nice.
Because it's a sort of a neoclassical idea of setting, like, say, a Schubert Lieder or a Brahms Lieder. It's not what contemporary music is now. So, and I know Edward Said talks about this quite a bit because he was quite an accomplished musician also, but that music has turned towards a kind of homeostatic kind of music. So you'll see, like, Messiaen, for instance, making music from bird song.
Oh, yeah.
And there isn't really the old form of music or the classical sensibility is you have an exposition, a development, and a recapitulation, which is not the how the world works anymore, right? That there is some sort of return that edifies and recaptures the exposition, and it's always somewhat triumphant. But after World War II, really, you don't have that possibility. And considering the genocide now, like, how do we make music that is exposition, development, a sort of triumphant recapitulation or return? Because the idea, even outside of the genocide, the climate crisis, and everything else, is that we can't have a return. So then I think about that in terms of what does it mean to set music or set poetry to music now. I think it has to address that in new musical language and in poetry, and I find that a tall order. Also because music is my first love, and I still, poetry is very much secondary for me. So I kind of have more of a fear about getting music right than
Oh, for
poetry
real?
right. Yeah.
When you listen to classical music, does it even have the same effect on you because you've been doing it, you've been listening to it for so long?
I think I'm a more informed listener. There is that. So, I'll look for, and I think this is what happens with a lot of, like, avid music listeners or performers, is that we look for very small variations on the same piece. You would have like 100 interpretations about, and this is very much like translation. A performer of classical music, or if you do a cover, it's a translation of the original work. So what I'm looking for and what I find interesting, even if it's the scoring is, it tells you what to do, is that you look for different interpretations and slight variances, and that's what I end up looking for. So it could be how I'm feeling. I could find a different interpretation of a different piece of music because at that moment, this is what I want.
Can you tell what the player is feeling through like a different variation? Like a
I
note?
don't.
Is it
I
like what's a
don't.
variation? Like
It's
a
a variation is how you'd have a phrase. A phrase in music is a sequence of notes. Someone could delay or extend a note. They would steal or extend the time or cut it shorter. And within the structure of the entire work of music, then you would see or feel like it could feel warmer, it could be more sentimental, it could be more exacting. But the feeling of it shows you within one work that so many variations of translation is possible. And as more of like an informed musician, I think that's probably I'm more particular to those nuances.
So we've been talking about for an hour now. Do you need to get going?
I have 7% on my phone, so I can probably talk for another 10 minutes, Tyler.
Okay, let's see.
We can also cut it short. It's
Would
totally
you like
fine.
to? It's fine with me.
No, do you have a question? I mean, I'm happy to
Well,
answer
I
anything
think
you want.
like my favorite, one of my favorite poems was da, 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 da. Richard's Exercise.
Okay. I can actually read that poem. I have it on my phone.
Okay, cool.
Let me find it. It's here. Cover file. Oh, will open. Here are my publications. Here it is. think it's near the end. Do you want me to read the whole thing or just part of it? Because it's quite long.
Just the my friend where it starts. Oh,
okay.
My friend is kidding.
Okay. Cool. Richard's exercise. My friend, it's a pity I didn't think to invent a new body until now. No chance my outer petals attract a bee, much less a model kiss my cheek save in a friendly way. No, it's whether I'll survive a fall, stumble with dignity, lock arms with a friend everywhere we go. Granted, that sounds rather pleasant. Twice a week, I ascend the demisphere and wave my arms to find solitude as firm as a monk who's given up his family, his job, his sex in exchange for time to figure out if his body was worth the price of his spirit and his mind. Is it any wonder I did it in reverse? My mind, a wonderfully stocked library in a drafty tower.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You wrote the poem through someone else's voice on that one?
Yeah, that's Richard's voice.
How is it? Could the readers be able to tell, or do you?
Honestly, I don't care. But I think it's. I think it's distinguishable, because the pacing is quite different from Richard's cadence. But it's not Richard's voice, right? It's my voice. This is how I think about it. So if they can differentiate it, they can differentiate it. If they can't, they can't, and that's okay. That's the freedom of the reader, I think.
Yeah, exactly. The monk thing, giving up solitude.
Yeah.
Giving up the family, the job, and sex.
Yeah, that was like what we say in Korea is like, and I think this is also a post-war thing, if you had nothing to live for and everything goes to shit, you shave your head and you go into the monastery.
Yeah? Oh, yeah. Cool. Have you ever thought about doing that? Being a monk?
I totally did. Yeah, especially when I wasn't out. I was like, well, if I become a monk. And I had a big, like, obnoxious Buddhist phase where I was meditating every day and was vegan and everything, or vegetarian.
How long did that last?
1 year.
1 year?
1 year. And then my mom told me the story about a monk in Africa where this, you know, Buddhist asked the monk, how could you eat meat? And the monk replied, my first job is to help others. And if the only way to stay alive is to eat protein, because that's what's most available, then that's what I'm going to do. And it's probably apocryphal and probably erroneous, but I was like, you know, I'm obnoxious and I should be a pleasant human being and not be like an elitist vegan, which is everyone's worst nightmare.
So, wait, do you think being a monk is elitist?
No, I mean, in the sense that if you can be an elitist about it, right?
Yeah.
I don't eat meat. I'm better than you. I'm more virtuous, that kind of thing. And that's what I mean about a virtuous monk.
You know, I watch professional wrestling, and there's a character that like did that. It's like
Recent one. Go ahead.
Oh, you can say.
Oh no, I thought it was like WWF or WCW. I haven't seen professional wrestling in a long time.
Yeah,
I was
CM Punk. He used to have a character where he's like straight edge.
Okay. Yeah. You really could be that, right? You could be a fascist monk.
Did you know WCW? They went over to Korea.
Oh, I didn't know that.
In North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like Collision in Korea was like the mid 90s. It was like they forced 199,000 people to watch a wrestling like pay per view.
Whoa, really?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, they like WCW, they didn't listen to the American government and they just went over there.
Uh huh.
And like, they got it going. Yeah, it's a crazy story.
Gosh, I wonder how they got there. I wonder if, because there's only one flight to North Korea now, and it's through Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the flight situation is now, but you can only go to North Korea through China now.
Yeah.
So that's wild. I have to look into that.
Yeah, like the people that were watching, or the wrestlers, they said like the people that were watching had no idea what they were watching. It was like completely alien to them.
Yeah, I can imagine the theatrics. Although, you know, the entire North Korean government is a kind of theatrics, right?
But that's very true.
Yeah.
All right, man. I think I'll let you go. It was fun having you on.
Yeah, Tyler, thank you so much. This is so much fun.
This is awesome. All right, I'll see you.
See ya. Bye.
Bye. That was Jimin Seo. That was really, it was a great conversation. I didn't know. Yeah, that was really cool. Is my, all right. Talk to you guys later.